This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Last night, President Bush strode onto one of the grandest stages in American politics. The House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Diplomatic Corps, and invited guests all rose to give him a standing ovation. He grasped the hand of supporters on his way down the aisle and then turned to deliver an address that is still broadcast live by all of the television networks. Analysis began as soon as he finished, about an hour later. In just a moment, presidential historian Robert Dalek will join us to talk about that moment and the broad themes of the State of the Union message. Later in the program, we'll focus on nuclear proliferation in Iran, in Libya, and in North Korea. We'll listen to excerpts from the testimony earlier today of an American scientist who got the best look yet at North Korea's nuclear capabilities. And former Ambassador Jack Pritchard, who was on that same visit to North Korea, will join us to talk about what he saw. But we'll begin with the State of the Union. Whether you support President Bush or not, what will you remember from this speech? Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Robert Dalek, professor of history at Boston University, the author of the books Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents, and To Lead a Nation, The Presidency in the 20th Century. He's with us from his home here in Washington. It's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
First of all, what did you think of the address? What was the president's message, do you think, and was he effective in delivering it?
Well, first, let me say, Neil, that what I find so striking as a historian is how different this address and the other recent State of the Union messages are from what we used to have in the 19th and even early years of the 20th century. You know, they were called messages because they were not speeches or addresses. They were sent over to the Congress by the White House in written form. And it was only with Woodrow Wilson in 1913 that they began to be oral presentations by the president in person before a joint session of Congress. And that changes the whole tone of how these messages are delivered, because they used to be terribly matter-of-fact. They would recount the number of railroads and railroad tracks that were being laid and what revenues were being compiled and the amount of taxation. And they were very factual and really not terribly stimulating reading. But nowadays, what they've become is a kind of political soapbox address, an attempt to justify the presidency of the individual holding the office, and particularly in an election year, justifying the policies of that president and speaking to the future about how he will make the country safer and more prosperous. And that's what Mr. Bush was trying to do last night, in my judgment. It was very much an election year stump speech rather than strictly a description of the State of the Union.
Well, talking about that just for a moment, the timing certainly suggested that it was about what you said it was about. Of course, it was just one night after the Iowa caucuses, and I guess one of the goals of the administration in scheduling it on that particular night was the president has an opportunity to look like, well, the president of the United States there in those grand surroundings, while Democratic candidates fresh from bashing each other are still squabbling in New Hampshire.
Yes. Well, also, you see, the Democrats in some ways had stolen the limelight from him, because that contest had become quite interesting and dominated the Iowa contest, dominated the news outlets, the media, and in a sense, the White House was trying to steal back some of the attention and limelight for the president. Whether it worked or not, we'll see in future days. But I think that was part of the motivation in having the speech on January 20th, because there's no compulsion to have it on the 20th. Often it's later in the month, and the Constitution does not dictate a particular date. In fact, it used to be given in December of each year rather than in January.
As you listen to the speech, though, some people were expecting something like an America in the morning kind of speech,
yes,
referring back to Ronald Reagan, of course. And instead, we got what some are describing as a very tactical speech.
Yeah, well, tactical and defensive, I would say, because this president has been hearing what the Democrats and his critics generally have been saying about him, about Iraq, about the economy, about jobs, about education, and he, in a sense, rose to the challenge or took the bait and responded to all that, justifying the war in Iraq, justifying his war against or campaign against terrorism, justifying his education programs, laying out an agenda on taxes that has been under considerable attack on the economy. So there was really a very defensive tone, I think, to this speech, much more so than one normally sees in a State of the Union address.
In what some candidates or campaigns describe as the opportunity to present a moonshot moment, well, the president presented an ambitious proposal to return to the moon and go on to Mars just before the State of the Union speech, and then didn't mention it last night.
Yeah, I think it's Neil, it's very striking that he didn't mention that, and there was really only, I think, one passing mention of the of his immigration reform proposal. And I think what that suggests is the White House has its ear close to the ground or is listening to the hearing the polls, and the reaction from the public to both those initiatives was not very positive. And so they were taken out of the, if they ever were in there to begin with, but they certainly didn't end up being in the speech.
What do you think was his strongest moment?
Well, I think the strongest moment is the one that he's been strongest about all along, namely his response to terrorism and his appeal to the country to understand that this war against terrorism is not over, that we might like to be comfortable about the fact that there's not been a follow-up terrorist attack since the 9/11 attack. But he said it would be a mistake to assume that we are now safe and comfortable and that we need to continue to be on alert. So I think that probably resonated most effectively with the public, because I think these domestic initiatives and talking about steroids for athletes and a possible constitutional amendment to about the sanctity of marriage, I don't think those resonated all that much with the public. But I think this appeal to stay alert and response to potential terrorist attacks was the strongest moment.
Yet it wasn't quite as red, white, and blue as previous moments, especially for a president who's talking to a nation at war.
Yep. Well, I think he's, you know, been somewhat sobered by the fact that they went to war based on the supposition that Saddam Hussein, that Iraq was preparing to possibly attack us with weapons of mass destruction, that they were building these chemical, biological, and even nuclear weapons as a potential threat to the United States. And, of course, none of this has materialized. And so the basis for the war on Iraq, of course, has come under very sharp criticism from not just the Democratic candidates, but from all sorts of independent sources. And so, in a sense, I think he's defensive on that, and he can't be quite as much the flag waver and defender of his policy as he could have been if they had found these weapons of mass destruction.
Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. We're speaking with presidential historian Robert Dalek, and let's take a call from Kathy, who's on the line with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. Just what your guest was saying was what was so actually not surprising to me. But when President Bush said, by seeking all the facts already, the Kay Report identified dozens of weapons of mass destruction-related program activities, that was a huge shift to the language that was used over and over again prior to the preemptive strikes of Iraq, when they used sentences like clear and imminent threat, mm-hmm. and we think they might, and now they're looking for the facts afterwards. I mean, the way I titled President Bush's speech last night was No Lie Left Behind.
The Kay Report, obviously a reference to David Kay, who's conducting a survey of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction programs such as they are.
Yes.
Well, the other st- statement was, words must be credible. No one doubts America's word. I mean, that's a laughingstock.
Well, he's talking about the credibility of the threat against Iraq, which was certainly fulfilled. Get a response from Robert Dalek?
Yeah, I think your caller's point is well taken. But what it demonstrates is how aggressive they are about making their case, regardless of the facts, regardless of what the realities are. You know, the idea is to convince the public, which at times is gullible, of course, about these things, that they're right, that what they've done is, you know, when you ask administration officials or supporters, was this a wise policy? Look, there aren't weapons of mass destruction. What they do is they shift the argument to the idea that we're really there fighting terrorism, and that this was the principal motive. Well, of course, that's not true, but this is what they have to say now. Reminds me in some ways of the Vietnam experience. There was a mayor in Los Angeles by the name of Sam Yorty who used to say, if we don't stop them in Vietnam, we'll have to stop them on the beaches of Santa Monica. And I used to wonder, well, who was he talking about, the Chinese, the Vietnamese? I mean, these are the kinds of fictions that that enter into the political dialogue, and particularly in an election year.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask also, as you know, as a public, here we are out here, we hear Paul O'Neill's statements and book coming out, and Mr. El Baradei's statement to the UN on March 7th of 2003, where he mm-hmm. says that there are no weapons of mass destruction, and then we have the report from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Right.
I mean, who in the hell do we believe?
We have this Ken Pollack who, you know, wrote a book urging the United States to urging the administration to go to war against Iraq because of the dangers from weapons of mass destruction. Now, here's an article in the current issue of The Atlantic magazine recanting, and he's furious over the fact that he feels misled by the intelligence agencies. So it's not just the Carnegie Endowment and Paul O'Neill, but you get someone who was a principal architect in some ways of this policy who's recanting.
Yet it should be said there are plenty of people who say, let's await the Kay report, see what he finds, and take a verdict from that. So it still may be premature, though obviously no stocks of ready weaponized weapons of mass destruction were found, or certainly not used, in Iraq.
Well, Neil, it's inconceivable to me that if they had found anything that they could have put forward as supporting their assertion, that we would not have heard about it repeatedly at this point.
Let's get a quick question in. We just have a little while left. Andy in Welch, Oklahoma is on the line.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I thought what was the most interesting part of the Bush's speech is when he was talking about the Patriot Act. And he said that the Patriot Act was going to expire in a year, and the Democrats started applauding. And for a moment, Bush looked confused, and then he looked angry. And I thought for a minute that he might get away from his speech and scold the Democrats. And then he decided to continue with his speech, and then the Republicans were so angry that they started clapping at the wrong time. They actually started clapping after Bush said that terrorism would not expire.
Right.
And I thought that just showed the represented kind of the division that we have in this country.
Hijacking that moment of the speech.
That's right.
Yeah. There were several moments when the reaction shots were quite telling, weren't they, Robert Dalek?
Well, they were indeed, especially when you saw Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, almost grimacing over some of what President Bush was saying about these Medicare reforms and prescription drug programs. There is, I think your caller is quite right, there is a very painful, deep divide in the country now over this administration and this president, and it extends around the world because, you know, American standing, it's not America's standing, this administration's standing with so many governments around the globe.
Robert Dalek is the author of To Lead a Nation, The Presidency in the 20th Century. When we come back, proliferation. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.